Thank you for coming today. As she said, I'm Kevin Gostola, and I write for a national news website called firedoglake.com, in case you are unfamiliar. If you wanted to write it down, it's firedoglake.com. And I've been here. I traveled out to the Cook County Criminal Courthouse out on 26th in California every day in the freezing, freezing cold, blizzardy conditions of Chicago. And I've been there, and I've heard all of these witnesses that the prosecutors have brought forward. I've listened very intently to what the undercover officers have said, what Officer Nadia Chico said about her time as she's targeting these men. And so I wanted to talk to you about all of this and what was happening with this case. And I'll just briefly summarize who is involved in this, who are the defendants. Their names are Brian Jacob Church, Brent Betterly, and Jared Chase. And these are three people who came from Florida. They were part of the Occupy encampments down there when those were still in existence and hadn't been destroyed by mayors of those cities. And they were in Fort Lauderdale and Miami, and they drove up here. It sounds like they tried to bum off free gas in order to make their way up here to Chicago. And they eventually got here in the last days of April 2012. We had the NATO meeting coming up on May 19th and 20th, and they knew that there would be a large political demonstration on May 18th, and they were excited to be a part of it. These people wanted to make a mark on the protest, but it's not clear what exactly they wanted to do to make their mark. And that's where the prosecutors have taken advantage of these young men, to add inferences to language that they used. And it's my understanding that they were just a part of the culture of the people who were organizing, and they were young. And I think this is something that a lot of people don't understand. The value of privacy is that you get to articulate unpopular things that you are in favor. You get to express your frustration, and you get to talk about things that you would like to do to other people, perhaps even individuals in power, which you might not ever act out, which you might not ever do to those people. But you could be joking, or you could be very serious about what you want to do. And I say that just to establish the fact that these two officers got these three young men on wires that they got through a court order after May 4th. May 4th to May 16th, they have all three of these individuals on tape saying things that aren't particularly favorable to them. But at the same time, the prosecutors have not presented any evidence that they were ever actively planning out anything. So just to quickly establish the prosecutor's case, and it's very slim and or non-existent entirely. They say that the prosecutors claim that these three men were planning to attack Obama's re-election campaign headquarters, attack four police stations with four people in simultaneous attacks. So 16 people, four people each were going to go to these stations and do some kind of an attack. The Chase Bank Tower, there was going to be some kind of an attack on that. And also Rahm Emanuel's home. Brian Jacob Church was apparently going to shoot a arrow at Rahm Emanuel's house to send a message because he doesn't like public officials. And so this is what they say about what they plan to do. They say that they were these three young men were going to take Molotov cocktails, and they were going to throw them at police because they wanted to see a cop on fire. And that's the prosecution's case. The larger picture, which the defense has tried to bring out in these proceedings, is that these three young men were targeted in a wide police surveillance operation prior to the NATO summit. And this is where I'm going to insert my analysis of what I've been viewing, and some of what I say here isn't exactly what the defense has been saying in the courtroom, but it's what I have interpreted as what I've seen presented. Starting in February 2012, they had the officers, Nadia Chico, who was known to the activists in Chicago as Gloves, nickname, and Nadia at times, and then Officer Mehmet Egan, who was known as Mo to the activists. They both were going to cafes, punk rock shows, going to public meetings, Occupy meetings. They were going to these locations and listening to people's conversations. Nadia says that her job was to observe, listen, and report back criminal activity. But what? And in fact, when they were at these locations, they found nothing. They came away with nothing. And they did this sort of surveillance, this widespread surveillance operation all through April, until eventually they got some tips, and they end up, through an activist, finding these two other guys who were known as Migs and Sabi. And this case was at one point the NATO Five. And those two, they've had their cases settled. One of them's on house arrest. I don't know the full details of their cases, so I won't get into them. But I know that those two individuals happened to introduce the two undercover officers to Chase, Church, and Betterly. And on the day of May Day, they went to the rally. Mo and Nadia dressed as if they were Black Bloc protesters. It's not clear how they knew that they needed to wear that clothing, but they came disguised as protesters and marched with these three at the front of the march. And then they went to an after party at a location in Chicago called the Multiculti. And they introduced themselves to Church. Church gave a phone number to Nadia, and that basically set the wheels in motion for all of this. I see this as being a case entirely fabricated out of suspicionless surveillance done in the city. And I'll get into more details, but I think I want to take advantage of something that I did as a reporter. I went and purchased 90 pages of a transcript of the court proceedings because I was very interested it stuck with me a lot of what happened when the cross-examination was ongoing between the defense attorney, Michael Deutsch, who is representing Brian Jacob Church, and then when he was cross-examining Nadia Chico. That was a very incredible moment for me to watch in the proceedings. And they put the police conduct into the center of the proceedings, making it something that the jury needed to consider. So I purchased these transcripts. Eventually we'll get them online for people to read this cross-examination that Deutsch did of Chico, but I wanted to read some of these highlights here so you can get a sense of what's really been happening in this trial. I think it's very critical. So Deutsch said to Chico, "My question is a little bit more specific, whether or not you were given in writing any rules of what you could do as an undercover officer." And she answered, "Well, what happens is, for NATO, when we went to these meetings, there was a general order that was written. We were supposed to go observe and listen, and if there was any criminal activity going on or anything that we heard of, that's what we would report back." And he later asked her, "In fact, in March and April of 2012, you went to many different public events and meetings." And she said, "Correct." And then Deutsch asked, "You didn't hear any criminal talk of criminal activity, correct?" She said, "Correct." "Yet you wrote reports about what went on at each one of these events, correct?" And she said, "We would go back and write a report of what happened that day. If there was no criminal activity, that would be the end of that document, and that was it, sir. We had to report back and say where we went, or else our supervisors would think that we didn't go, sir." And then Deutsch said, followed up with this question, "So the reason why you wrote a report detailing the names of people who were at a public meeting or the license plates of people that attended a meeting was because your supervisor might think you didn't go to the meeting?" And her answer was, "No, sir. We document the fact that we went, and we would, if we needed to look into things, we would. If nothing came about from that, that would be it for that, sir, and we would move on to the next event. Every day we went to different things, sir. But what is clear is they're collecting this information that's innocent, and we don't know right now where this information is. It's not clear from what I've heard that any of it was destroyed. So if you were at any of these events before the NATO summit, you might be concerned. The other thing I want to bring up here is that during this cross-examination, she explains the sort of culture inside of the department of why they were actually going out to these locations. So Deutsch asked, now, your assignment was to spy on Occupy Chicago and anarchist groups, correct? And her answer was, no, sir. My assignment was to go out to various locations where there was a meeting, there was a rally, a protest. I went to coffee shops. I went to concerts. I went to parks. It was just to observe and listen for criminal activity, sir. That was my assignment. What were you looking for? Were you looking for anarchists? Deutsch asked. No, sir. We were just looking and waiting to see, trying to see if anybody said anything about criminal activity. We wanted to go home every night, sir. When we didn't have anything, we went back. We filled out a piece of paper, and we were done. Just like that. So later, she says that she went to a music event where a band played. And she was told that anarchists had been known to, that the band had been known to attract anarchists in the past. So they went there. And she said, the thing is, in the past, there have been times where violent anarchists have actually infiltrated peaceful organizers and peaceful protesters and actually got them to commit acts of violence or just kind of put themselves in that position so they can commit acts of violence. We were trying to weed out if anybody was there talking about acts of violence. As you can see, sir, we didn't observe anything and we left. That's reported on there. The whole pretext of going into the activist communities of Chicago is that they're going to root out and or weed out these violent anarchists. And I don't particularly know many people who, or look for criminal activity, and I don't particularly know a lot of people who are very open about the criminal activity they're going to commit in public settings. You just don't run your mouth loudly. Typically, if you're planning anything, the other thing I'll raise is just this talk about photographing license plates is phenomenal to me. And she says basically that they go and they run people's plates. That's how we sometimes find warrants and stuff, sir. That we're police officers. That's what we do. And she says that as if everyone should accept this as something that is entirely normal of the police to just go and do it's like a courtesy for us all that she's running our plates and seeing if we have warrants. And then the better part here, and I read this on the Heartland Cafe's radio program this morning. I'll read just a section of it again. Was just that she talked about being at the Heartland Cafe, which had been around 35 years in the Rogers Park community, and how she had been detailed to go there. They had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 police officers assigned to go into the Heartland Cafe. And she said, just because you go in and you are assigned to it, you may be outside just doing surveillance, making sure your undercover is safe. The other officers that come that are on here are for our safety, sir. That doesn't mean that they went in. And I don't know, I was at the Heartland Cafe. It doesn't look like any violent people are hanging out, but that was the sense that the police had. And, you know, Deutsch asked her, so you think as a Chicago police officer you have a right to go into a restaurant and listen to people's conversations to hear whether they are talking about criminal activity? Of course, the prosecutor wouldn't stand for that question, and we did not get an answer from Nadia because the prosecutor objected to that question. So that gives you a sense of what has been happening with the undercover officer. And these officers, they go up on the stand. They have their preconceived notions and theories. And they don't hold up because there's no evidence to support the narratives that they're creating. And then this is where I'll wrap up my presentation with bringing in my analysis of what I see happening here. Having covered National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden and those revelations, I see this as being a prime example of why you cannot allow indiscriminate surveillance. I see the activity that the Chicago Police Department was engaged in as mirroring or being almost identical to what the New York Police Department does to Muslim communities out in that city, in New York, and the immediate areas in New Jersey. And I see them basically having this idea about who these three people were or who they were looking for. They had a clear idea of who they were looking for in these locations. And they went into these places and they looked for people with black bandanas, or they looked for people who had tattoos. They analyzed their tattoos to pick out these individuals. And they took note of the speakers who were giving presentations. And they made notes of what was being talked about at these locations. And I recognize that this isn't a new historical thing here in Chicago. I know that this goes back decades. In the 60s and 70s, this was a routine thing of the police to do to people. And I recognize that this country has a long history of targeting activists. But nonetheless, I approach this in such a novel way just because I think it is something to take seriously. And what I see happening here is that they fabricated a case entirely out of suspicionless surveillance, and they decided that they were going to set the wheels in motion for finding some people that they wanted to arrest or apply their resources to. And this has a self-perpetuating aspect to it, because once you send people out to do surveillance, then you have to find targets. Well, if you're not finding targets, then you become desperate. Then you start to look for the best thing. Well, they had already been putting out in the media that people from out of town were going to come to the city and they were going to do a lot of damage to property here in Chicago. And they were worried about the Black Bloc, because we heard actually in these proceedings that they looked to Toronto, where the G20 had happened and there had been some property damage, and they were concerned about the Black Bloc protesters coming and doing some damage here. So they had this whole mindset of who they were going to go after, and then they found these three guys, and they'd actually done what they were afraid of. They had traveled here to Chicago, and they were planning to protest. And then they fit this mold, this sort of people that they were capable of manipulating and pressing their buttons, and the undercover officers played on their defects, basically. Their drug addiction, their constant abuse of alcohol, it would seem, some of them having substance abuse issues, and they showed them that they were veteran activists, basically. Like, Mo stood out as a kind of role model, talking about things that you could do. They even have him on tape saying things like, Molotovs, I'll make some, or Molotovs, make it rain, or stuff like that, just like saying things that give you the sense that it would be okay and acceptable to go down this path of making the Molotov cocktails. And eventually you get to the house, the raid, and on May 16th, these people are arrested, and they got the bare minimum of what they needed in order to get a search warrant and arrest these guys. And then the mugshots are in the news the couple days before the NATO meeting. And everyone thinks that they've rounded up terrorists. And then I say self-perpetuating because you realize that you don't have what you actually thought you had. And that's when the federal government decides that they're not going to prosecute the case. These are guys who were going to allegedly threaten Obama's campaign reelection headquarters, a NATO meeting where you've got dignitaries from all over the world coming. That's a federal issue, and now the state's prosecuting them under a state terrorism law. And I think that that's particularly interesting because it shows you how weak and paper thin the case happens to be. And so I conclude by saying that I think I wouldn't suggest that the three have it particularly well here with the jury, that they're going to get off, that they're not going to be convicted. But what I will say is that publicly, the state's attorney office can see when they read the media that there has been quite a bit of interest in the police conduct. And there has been quite a bit of criticism of the fact that the state's attorney office has even considered bringing the case and that they have taken this to trial. And I'll leave it there. I'll leave it there and say that I don't know exactly how these men are going to end up. I cannot give a good sense here that they are, in fact, going to be convicted of all the charges, including the terrorism charges. I think that they have some very good defense attorneys that have proven themselves capable of making the arguments that if anybody was going to get them off, they would be the defense attorneys you would want to have in that room. But I think it just depends on what they're able to do to orient the jury before they go in and do that deliberation. I mean, that's a standard thing for any trial, obviously, but it'll be crucial because the prosecution has left it so wide open with many different details not established, with playing this kind of association game of saying, here are some things they said on the internet. They talked about how they might like to see an officer on fire here, and they talked about how they might like to do this, and they talked about how they were very upset and angry because these men actually got stopped, and they were stopped by police in the weeks before the NATO meeting, and the police were threatening them, asking them questions about where they came from, saying they're going to take a billy club to their skulls, it's going to be just like 68, and the Democratic National Convention all over again, and they're agitating the NATO three intentionally, it would seem. And so you would have known at that point that they had undercover officers. You would hope that they would have known at that point that there was undercover officers out in the field who were targeting them. But I don't know. I've seen a lot of things in this case, and it's possible that they weren't coordinating. I mean, we don't know if those officers were on the same page with the police intelligence division. But I think they would have had to have been. And so you go to the day when they're arrested, and I emphasize that the prosecutors have not put forward a lot of evidence, and at the same time, that jury, you just have to think that maybe not being given a lot, not being wholly directed on what to think, that might give them a lot of leeway at the time that they give their closing argument, that the prosecutor is going to take advantage of that to convince them that they should be guilty.